American music, dog music from David Grisman with Tony Rice and Vassar Clemens getting ready for the 4th of July on today's show. We'll take a few juicy slices from the most patriotic statement I've ever heard. It's 180 words, and it's so rich that we could mine it for hours and hours of radio. But in this hour, just a few slices from E.B. White's Definition of Democracy. He wrote it in 1943 when, as a writer at the New Yorker magazine, he received a letter from the Writers War Board. They asked for a statement on the meaning of democracy. White wrote that, quote, "It is presumably our duty to reply with such a request, and it is certainly our pleasure." Here is his statement. "Surely the board knows what democracy is. It is the line that forms on the right. It is the don't in don't shove. It is the hole in the stuffed shirt through which the sawdust slowly trickles. It is the dent in the high hat. Democracy is the recurrent suspicion that more than half of the people are right more than half of the time. It is the feeling of privacy in the voting booths, the feeling of communion in the libraries, the feeling of vitality everywhere. Democracy is a letter to the editor. Democracy is the score at the beginning of the ninth. It is an idea which hasn't been disproved yet, a song the words of which have not gone bad. It's the mustard on the hot dog and the cream in the rationed coffee. Democracy is a request from a war board in the middle of a morning, in the middle of a war, wanting to know what democracy is." E.B. White, 1943. "Surely the board knows what democracy is." Coming up on this hour, we'll hear some thoughts on the privacy of the voting booths, the feeling of communion in the libraries. Both of those are part of E.B. White's definition of democracy. And we'll hear Fred Friedman on the score at the top of the ninth, and a new story from Matthew Miltich about an old American virtue. My name is Michael Goldberg, and I always get excited for the 4th of July. Not too soon for me to start celebrating. I love the idea of everybody in the country celebrating the same thing together outdoors, at parades and street dances, in parks by rivers and lakes, in backyard barbecues, pickup ball games. I'm proud to be an American on the 4th of July. I have a number of friends who might feel a little embarrassed for me when they hear me say that. They either think I'm not thinking clearly or am being ruled by naive sentiment. Because for them, patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels, a tool of empire, of domination, a sign of conformity. Actually, I don't know if they're embarrassed for me or not, probably just annoyed at me. And of course, I can hear what they think, but I don't know exactly what they feel. In this, I am ruled by sentiment, the feelings I get from sharing public spaces with strangers, from holding my hat over my heart at the ball game. I imagine my grandparents meeting my grandchildren, comparing America to the old country. Cue the Statue of Liberty, the amber waves of grain. I disagree with my friends who confuse love of country with militarism, who do not want to pledge allegiance. Democracy, E.B. White says, is the line that forms on the right. Maybe you don't like to stand in line any more than I do. If you can get a VIP pass or fly first class, you don't have to, I guess. Who's the true patriots here? The ones who take a free ride on privileges, or the ones who believe in E.B. White's democracy? He says it's the don't in Don't Shove. Democracy has muscle, it has to make sure the strong don't walk over the weak. Nobody gets to shove their own interest ahead of everybody else's. Democracy is the muscle, the don't in Don't Shove. Muscles, of course, have to be exercised. That's why I so admire people like Sheila Parmalee, the middle school teacher who was detained for hours at a checkpoint in Arizona while driving home to California. Here in America, we have to have immigration checkpoints inside the homeland. So she drives up and the ICE agent says, "Are you a U.S. citizen?" Parmalee says, "Are we crossing a border?" "No," says the immigration officer. "Are you a U.S. citizen?" "So, like, if I say yes, then you'll wave me through, is that right? But if I had an accent or brown skin, would I have to prove it that I'm a citizen, or just go on? You know, I'm a teacher, and a lot of us are sick of seeing our kids being discriminated against." And then she gave him one of her teacher looks. The uniform took a breath, remembered his training, and said, "Are you a U.S. citizen?" Well, she refused to answer the question, at which point they pulled her over and held her at the checkpoint for a while, more than an hour, while she got busy online and they got busy asking superior officers for guidance. And finally, they let her go on her way because they had no reason not to. A patriot is what I call her. What happens when every American driving through those checkpoints refuses to answer the question? We actually might all get a chance to do that without leaving home if they include a citizenship question on the census. Just don't answer. Because it takes muscle to put the don't in Don't Shove. That's what democracy looks like.
"Excuse me, mister, something you should know. I don't look for trouble, but you're standing on my toe. Somebody's gonna have to move, somebody's got to go. Somebody's gonna have to move, you're standing on my toe. Excuse me, lady, just a word with you. I don't like to bother, but you're blocking out my view. Somebody's gonna have to move, only thing to do. Somebody's gonna have to move, you're blocking out my view." "Square. I'm a peaceful fella, but you're sitting in my chair. Somebody's gonna have to move, the only thing that's fair. Somebody's gonna have to move, you're sitting in my chair. You're messing with my groove. Somebody's gonna have to move."
Music from Mose Allison. I'm going to get back to E.B. White's definition of democracy, but first, let's go to the movies. That's a long-standing tradition for the 4th of July weekend. Here's our professor of pop culture, Jack Nachbar.
It's odd. You'd think the celebration of the birthday of the United States would rev up Hollywood to make dozens of 4th of July movies, like Christmas has. But nope, there's hardly any. When TCM celebrates the 4th, they trot out old military movies. Patriotic? Sure. But these movies skip the day itself. When Jimmy Cagney gave his Oscar-winning turn as entertainment George M. Gohan in the 1942 hyper-patriotic Yankee Doodle Dandy, the only time the 4th of July comes up is in a song mentioning Gohan's birthday. Luckily for us, the 1980s gave us two genuine July 4th pictures we can gobble down along with the potato salad and the hot dogs. But by the 80s, pure patriotism in the movies was long gone. These movies bite and snarl. Oliver Stone's Born on the 4th of July was a monster hit in 1980. The credits of this film biography picture a small-town 4th of July celebration. Young Ron Kovic is mesmerized. The parade honors vets, and we hear it's a grand old flag playing on the soundtrack. A bit later, young Ron hits a walk-off homer and enjoys his first kiss. A perfect American boyhood day. And a perfect birthday, too, since, like George Gohan, Ron was born on the 4th. Still later, spurred on by his childhood love of country, Ron joins the Marines right out of high school and not long after is happy to ship out to Vietnam. Ron turns out to be a violent nightmare. Ron discovers he's killed children in a village and accidentally kills one of his comrades. Then he himself suffers a wound that costs him the use of his legs. He returns from Nam in pain and with serious PTSD. In a second 4th of July scene, Ron tries to speak patriotic niceties to a crowd, but he quickly breaks down. Soon after, he loses his high school sweetheart and finds that trivial jobs appear to be his only future. American has taken this Yankee Doodle Dandy and crushed him. Ron saves himself when he finally realizes that the war in Vietnam was an insanity foisted on America under a false cloak of patriotism. He turns into a famous war protester. By doing so, he becomes a genuine patriot. At the end of the movie, he's about to address the 1976 Democratic Convention. As your grand old flag again plays over the closing credits, we realize the unquestioning loyalty to jingo patriotism is in reality a cruel illusion. True love of country includes questioning and rebelling against authority. Another blockbuster hit, Independence Day in 1986, unlike the Tom Cruise picture, is a barrel of fun. The plot is simple and nuts. On the 4th of July, the U.S. defeats seemingly huge hordes of seemingly invulnerable aliens. The heroic characters represent American assimilation and equality. The president is a WASP. The fighter pilot is African-American. The computer genius is Jewish. However, all the American rah-rah takes another turn when armed forces all over the world unite to defeat the world threat. Patriotism takes on an international meaning. In our 21st century, unless you count some TV stuff, there are so far no hit 4th of July movies. Nada. Unless, as Peter Biskin argues in his recent book, The Sky is Falling, the most popular movies these days are given over to what he calls extreme culture, in which traditional American norms have broken down. In the Hunger Games trilogy, for example, the government exploits the working class for the sake of the rich. Heroine Katniss Everdeen must lead a revolution. The 2009 Avatar, at the time, was the all-time top-grossing movie. Big business leaders in the military in the film are greedy, corrupt, and indifferent to any unlike themselves. They invade the planet Pandora, a lovely Garden of Eden populated by the peaceable and spiritual Navi, a thinly disguised symbol of Native Americans. The humans want to exploit the planet. Genocide is their preferred strategy. Happily, the awful humans are defeated. Only our hero Jake remains. To cleanse himself of his evil earthly roots, Jake himself becomes a Navi. Steve Rogers, the ultra-American Captain America, in the current Marvel multi-movie saga, reflects a nation George M. Cohan would never have recognized. In Captain American Civil War in 2016, Cap violates government plans and goes rogue to save his old pal Bucky. At the end of the current Avengers Endgame, the possible all-time box office champ, Rogers can no longer live in the present at all. He returns to the past, where he marries his 1940s love, Peggy Carter, and with Peggy, builds a new life. Cap's fellow Avenger, Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel, is most at home on other planets and returns to Earth only when summoned. There just isn't a place in our big hit movies anymore for a rah-rah 4th of July celebration. Our society and government are pictured as no longer worth celebrating. Our heroes are alienated. Still, some old-fashioned feelings linger. At the end of Born on the 4th of July, Ron Kovic says, "Lately, I felt like I'm home." Captain America gets a life with Peggy he's always wanted. In Avatar, Jake begins a peaceful new life on Pandora, at home in nature with the woman he loves. In the 2017 Logan, X-Man Wolverine overcomes deep despair and rescues a group of mutant children from an evil corporation. Laura, one of the children, recognizes Wolverine as her father, and he dies peacefully in her arms. So, on the 4th, eat a second, even a third piece of fried chicken. Ooh and ah at the fireworks. Salute the grand old flag. We are living in very troubled times, but if our new movies don't celebrate our American birthday, at least they offer us glimmers of hope.
Jack Nachbar takes a second look at the movies for us here on Stay Human. John Williams wrote the theme music for Born on the 4th of July, and he wrote this for the Revolutionary War movie, The Patriot. Today on Stay Human, we're taking some swings at E.B. White's definition of democracy. He says it's the score at the top of the ninth. Baseball has always presented itself in its marketing and in our popular culture as the quintessentially American sport. From the start, even when pro ball was all white, baseball was the game whose stars grew up in humble circumstances, where you didn't have to be big to be important. And long before the schools or the workforce or even the U.S. military desegregated, Major League Baseball broke the color line. And on today's teams, probably a quarter of the players are immigrants. It was a little weird, though, being at Target Field a few weeks ago. The crowd looked like the Minnesota of 50 years ago compared to the colorful crowd I'd been part of the day before at Como Park Zoo. That was full of families from all over the world, as many African-Americans as Norwegian-Americans, all Minnesotans, all out for the day. Baseball's not all that democratic, I guess, no more than any big business. I asked Fred Friedman what he thought about democracy as the score at the beginning of the ninth, E.B. White's line. I called on Fred because he's a frequent guest on Northern Community Radio's sports page, heard Thursday mornings. He knows a lot about a lot. He's been a lawyer and law professor for over 40 years, most of his career as a public defender. When I told him that I wanted to do something on the radio for the 4th of July, he said he's not feeling so optimistic about the democracy that E.B. White was talking about. He thinks we're already in extra innings and we're the visiting team. Time to rally.
Well, here's what it means. We don't have any clock, but who's ever winning at the end of nine innings, they win the game, that it's over with. And the top of the ninth means the visiting team bats first, home team gets last ups, and then the fourth and the seventh and the third, if somebody home team scores, you get to come back and score or not score. But the ninth inning is the last time you get to score and somebody has to tie it up. If they score in the bottom of the ninth or extra innings in a tied game, it's over with. And the fear is that something will happen and it'll be over with. We won't be able to recover. So I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but here we go. 4th of July coming, Michael. How's this? It's been the top of the ninth a lot of times in American history, and we've pulled it out. All right? We had a 6'4" dude who married the richest person in Virginia, and he fought in the French and Indian War for the British, and he got chased. We're talking about George Washington, of course, and he got chased all over the colonial states, the Middle Atlantic and New York, all the way down to what's now Maryland. And he had a heck of an arm. He's the first guy to ever throw a silver dollar across the Rappahannock. Only he and Walter Johnson have ever done that, by the way. And Walter Johnson was a great pitcher for the Washington Senators. Everybody knows what they said about Washington, first in war, first in peace, and last in the American leg. And Washington got chased. It was the top of the ninth, and he wasn't doing anything. He had nobody on base. He avoided the British battle after battle after battle after battle. People were starving. They had nothing. They got stuck in the winter of 1777-78 at a Philadelphia suburb called Valley Forge, while the British had taken over Philadelphia and were sleeping in people's mansions. And they had no shoes, they had no nothing, and this is a true story. Talk about, here's the very opposite of pessimism. A 19-year-old kid went in French, didn't even speak English, talked his way into Washington's tent and says, "I know you don't have children, and if you, my dad's dead, the British killed him, I hate the British. If you let me treat you as your father, I'll let you treat me as my son. And all you got to do is make me a 2-star general, a major general." And Washington laughed at this kid and says, "Well, why should I do that? You got to be joking. I'd love to treat you as my son, but why should I make you a 2-star general?" He says, "Well, I'm the 3rd richest guy in France. I'm married to the 4th richest woman in France. And I'm tight with Louis XVI. And if you let me treat you as my dad, I'll get King Louis XVI to commit the French army and the French navy, and we'll win the war." And Washington says, "Deal." And this kid took a couple of wounds at Germantown and Monmouth, led the successful charge at Yorktown, and won the war. And the kid's name was the Marquis de Lafayette. Yelled and screamed in letter after letter to Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Monroe about the evils called slavery. And we were in the top of the ninth between a tall guy named Washington and a short and a French guy named Lafayette. We've pulled that out before. We can do it again, but we got to beat some odds. So, yeah, I'm as patriotic as everybody else. Just got to call it as you see it.
Now listen to me, you guys. This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else, something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need. Now listen to me, you guys. This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else, something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope. Mustn't sit around and mope. Nothing's half as bad as it may appear. Wait till next year and hope. When your luck is batting zero, get your chin up off the floor. Mister, you can be a hero. You can open any door. There's nothing to it but to do it. You gotta have heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course, but keep that old horse before the cart. First, you gotta have heart.
A great slugger we haven't got.
A great pitcher we haven't got.
A great ball club we haven't got.
What do we got?
Getting the idea.
We've got hope. We don't sit around and mope. Not a solitary sob do we heed, mister, cause we've got hope.
Boys, I'm proud of you.
We're so happy that we're humming.
That's the hearty thing to do.
Hoo, hoo, hoo.
Cause we know our ship will come in.
So it's 10 years overdue.
Hoo, hoo, hoo.
We've got heart. Miles and miles and miles of heart. Oh, it's fine to be a genius, of course, but keep that old horse before the cart.
So what the heck's the use of crying?
Why should we cuss?
We gotta get better, cause we can't get worse. And to add to it, we've got heart. We've got heart. We've got heart.
Top of the ninth, one away, nobody on.
You are tuned in to your Northern Community Radio Service, KAXE-KBXE, where you'll always find a lot of heart. Our broadcast service is supported by the creative contributions of our many volunteers, the on- and off-air participation of folks throughout northern Minnesota, and the financial contributions of our listeners who know a good thing when they hear it. You can join us at kaxe.org. We also receive support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. My name is Michael Goldberg, and I'm getting ready for the 4th of July with stories and music and by studying on E.B. White's definition of democracy. It makes it clear that democracy is not a done deal. It's a work in progress. He wrote it at a point in World War II where our very existence as a country seemed in doubt. But then that has been the case before. It's in the nature of the beacon that America shines to the world. Freedom and equality, democratic rule, if you can hold on to it. Writer Matthew Miltich is a frequent contributor to this program, and he helps us celebrate the 4th of July this year with a story about one of the foundations of our civil society, neighbors who aren't the same as you.
Getting home safe is what it's all about. Knowing if we don't win today, it may be a shame, but not a serious one, and tomorrow is another day, another game. Baseball, yes. After all these years, after all my wins and losses, I pay attention still to baseball, and especially to our professional home team, the Minnesota Twins. But my love of the American national pastime didn't come to me naturally exactly. No, it was a gift from an unlikely source. When I was a kid, I felt that my family and I were not Americans in exactly the same way as the other kids in my town and their families were. My grandmother couldn't speak English, and my grandfather spoke it with a heavy accent. Grandpa made beer and wine in his basement, and he gardened his whole backyard in the iron mining town where he and Grandma lived. When I visited them with my father, who otherwise made efforts to be as American as possible, he spoke with his parents in a language I couldn't understand. The place they'd come from, where my father had lived part of his boyhood, they called Stary Kraj, the old country, and baseball wasn't in any way meaningful or important to any of them. My mother was an only child whose father died when she was 11, raised after that death by her widowed mother alone, a public school teacher. My brothers and sisters and I, her 10 children, understood that her wedding to my father made of their union what was then called a mixed marriage, opposed by her Protestant extended family. We were Roman Catholic. I never heard one word from her about baseball, not even a metaphor. At Catholic school during recess and after school, I learned to play a form of baseball we called workup, and so knew about baseballs and bats and gloves, how to hit the ball and to field it. But my introduction to the magic of the game, the romance of it, came from a staunch, old-money, plutocratic bachelor, a patrician and a Presbyterian, who lived with his two sisters in a late 19th century three-story, well, mansion, I have to call it, the biggest house in town, across the alley from us, when I was 8 years old, after my parents and eight of us kids, soon to be 10, moved into our new house. Moneyed people whose parental family owned mineral rights to mining lands and big tracts of timber in northern Minnesota, the three old people in the big white house across the alley were suspicious of us, a family with an Eastern European name moved into their neighborhood, a grandfather who'd been blacklisted by the Oliver Mining Company for organizing, saved by Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Works Progress Administration. We were Kennedy Democrats, papists, to use that old word, working-class people who'd made it into the American middle class. In our turn, we didn't trust those old neighbors either. They were Republicans, people of position, and of a class that had become rich by exploiting the lands of the native people and the labor of the poor, many of them, like my father's family, desperate immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe. But the shady green yard around that big white house fascinated and attracted my little brothers and me. Boysenberry bushes and blackcurrant bushes and lush lilacs, too many to count, and mountain ash and lilies of the valley grew under giant elms and white oaks around the house and grounds. Beside the garage behind the house, a great spreading crabapple bloomed pink and white in spring and then filled with apples, tiny and green at first, then ripe and red and sour, but irresistible to a boy like me. The old souls within the manse were a curiosity to us as well, because they were reclusive and thus mysterious. They rarely showed themselves to us. Lights burned in their upper story windows in the wee hours, and cats, uncounted numbers of them, came out from and went into that house throughout the day. The old man wandered the neighborhood late at night calling to them, and we heard him from our darkened bedrooms as he chanted, "Kitty, kitty, kitty," his attempts to reassemble that glaring, however many cats they were. One of the sisters whom we had never seen, handicapped in some way we kids had no way of understanding, died in that house. And then it was just the two of them left there, brother and sister, two children grown old in their wealthy parents' house, alone together in all those rooms. The antipathy between us kids and our elderly neighbors slowly evaporated, though. Our curiosity and the sort of natural attraction that occurs sometimes between the old and the very young pulled us together. The old woman opened the back door of her great house one day to tell my brothers and me we ought not to trap squirrels with our crude box trap, which we'd set beneath the bird feeder suspended from a tree in her yard. Squirrels are meant to live free, she told us. The very feeding of wild birds, as she did, seemed to me an oddity. Our father told us how in the old country, as a boy, he caught songbirds with deadly little traps fashioned of stones, and how his family ate the birds thus killed, the better to avoid starvation. The birds fed them, and not the other way around. Yet our neighbor lady was charming in her way, and she was right, we felt, about the squirrels, truly, when we thought about it, even as children. And before long, whenever we saw her, she spoke cheerily to us. So we'd misjudged her, we understood, and we were respectful to her, so she and we gained each other's confidence, the prelude to friendship. And at last we met her brother, who took me to my first ball game. The old man dressed as a dandy, but as one living in the 19-teens, which, as I think I understand now, was where, in his likes and preferences, he actually lived. In summer, he wore dapper white linen suits and bow ties, two-toned wingtip shoes, and when he ventured out, a straw boater on his head. He was the only man in our small town who dressed so. His full head of hair matched the color of his suits. He drove a 1938 LaSalle touring car, a 12-cylinder job, light brown with dove gray upholstery on the seats. As we kids and those two old souls became friends, my little brothers and I were invited into and had shortly, fantastically, the run of the house, furnished in turn-of-the-20th-century trappings, woven Persian rugs and heavy velvet curtains, cut glass doors, 10-foot ceilings with carved white oak crown moldings, massive, heavy sliding doors into the formal dining room, with stained glass windows fitted high into the west wall in there. White oak staircases and polished oak banisters fit for sliding down. On the third floor, the ballroom floor, yes, a ballroom, was covered with piles of books, every one of them having been read by the lady of the house at some time during her long life. Heaped so high a child's head came barely to their tops, the books were so many, there was left in that enormous room only a narrow aisle between the stacks upon which to walk between them. All books that had come into the house remained there, apparently, but also copies of every issue of the National Geographic magazine ever published lay in heaps on the steps of the staircases. Editions of all the Sports Illustrated issues from its very inception were piled about in the old man's bedroom. Copies of all the issues printed of the New Yorker, these for the lady, a truly voracious reader who read deep into every night, were arranged in lopsided stacks in her office. It might have been that everything that had entered that house ever, except for groceries and their packaging, stayed right there. I knew two certainties about the old man. He'd been in the U.S. Army during World War I, but not served overseas. And he'd once been engaged to be married, but his parents disapproved of his betrothed, and so he'd broken it off and come home. The old man had one enduring passion we knew about, baseball. We found an artifact of this in a glass-fronted curios case in the dining room, a baseball signed by every player of the New York Yankees ball club, of which he was a fan. From what year, I might then have heard, but have long since forgotten. Innocent of its value and significance, and having no other access to genuine Major League baseballs, my brothers and I played catch with it and batted it around. I was maybe 10 years old the first time our old neighbor invited me to come with him to a baseball game. I was myself too unorganized and already, at that tender age, too allergic to organization of any kind to be involved in an organized sport myself, and I had never attended any organized sporting event, but he asked me if I'd like to come to a baseball game with him, and I was surprised, actually, when my dad agreed I could go with the old man to an evening ball game at the American Legion Field, where some of the young men of our town, older high school players, or those recently graduated or home from college for the summer, played for the town team. On an evening cool and fair in June, Our gentleman neighbor and I, he in his white linen suit and boater, and I in jeans and t-shirt, tooled up to the north end of town in his LaSalle touring car, my first ride of many in that venerable automobile, to the ballpark. I remember mostly from that first game the field itself, the diamond and bases and base paths, the raked dirt of the infield, the expanse of neatly mown grass, and far away the outfield fence, the light standards against the darkening summer sky, such an American geometry. I felt immediately and unaccountably comfortable in the stands as the game began, and became immediately engaged and immersed in its play-by-play. I knew already enough from sandlot games to appreciate what I was seeing. Those young players, to my 10-year-old self, seemed heroic, giants. Did our town team win or lose? I don't remember. It's no matter. From the first pitch, I felt a little bit more comfortable in my own hometown. During that summer, I regularly attended the town games with my unlikely old partner, and we watched baseball games together again the following summer and the next summer after that, and finally we brought my next two younger brothers to the games with us. Baseball got into me thus, its rhythms and counts and shapes and implements. I adopted it as my own. The Washington Senators baseball team arrived in Minnesota, transformed into the new Minnesota Twins ball club, and I listened to broadcasts of their games on the radio. Baseball became for me a lifelong enthusiasm, a minor passion, yes, but a real one. For our part, my family adopted our aging neighbors, who were otherwise alone, without children, and unattended. They did have a living family member, a brother, we learned, who lived in the Twin Cities with a wife and children of his own, but he never came to see his brother and sister, and they did not speak of him otherwise. We kids regularly and frequently visited those two old souls and played in their house, and they themselves ventured across the snowy alley between our houses on Christmas night, year after year, to celebrate with us in our home, and came to us also on their birthdays, when my mother baked a cake for the one or the other, and we sang to and celebrated them. We shared with them summer picnics in our backyard, and we delivered to them, as they grew older yet and housebound, holiday meals from our kitchen. Neither we nor they, based on our friendly relations, changed our political views or religion or the way we understood American history or the news of the day. But we did find a way to accept and to be kind to one another, safe in each other's homes and each other's company, all of us a little richer for our respect and affection for each other. That was a long time ago.
Oh, beautiful. For spacious sky, for amber waves of green, for purple mountains vanished day, above the fruited plains, America, America, God shed His grace on thee and crown the good with brotherhood, from sea to shining sea.
That's Martin Sexton's beautiful rendition of that song, the song that really should be our national anthem. Too bad Sexton only recorded the first verse. I'm partial to the third one, too. Oh, beautiful for heroes proved in liberating strife, who more than self their country loved, and mercy more than life. America, America, may God thy gold refine, till all success be nobleness, and every gain divine. E.B. White says, democracy is the recurring suspicion that more than half the people are right more than half the time. It is the feeling of privacy in the voting booths. My friend and fellow American Molly McGregor feels something like what I feel on the 4th of July around Election Day. Here she tells us why.
I remember going to vote at the Episcopalian Church near my house on West 46th Street and DuPont in South Minneapolis with my dad. My dad was a lawyer and an officer in the Army Reserves. He was always in a uniform. This time, wingtips, suit, Oxford cloth shirt, bow tie. I felt safe with him, but sometimes embarrassed too. He was a big man, and he took his space. My brothers were with. Dad wanted us to know what it was like to vote. It was important that we learn it early. I think it was 1964, the presidential election. I don't remember exactly. I do remember that the judges were friendly and very happy to see us. I remember everything went very fast. I remember the church basement, with the judges paired at several tables and temporary booths placed at the room's perimeter, looked the same as any other polling place I've been to since. Maybe that memory is the game that one's brain lets us play, but my dad is with me when I vote, and I hope I am with my kids when they vote. I have voted in small towns, city community centers, and now by mail, well in advance of the election. I love voting. I love helping the judge find my name on the roll, Mac, not Mick, as my dad taught me, and then signing in, taking my ballot, entering the booth, carefully marking the circles, then feeding the ballot into the machine and accepting my I voted sticker and heading back to work, acknowledging colleagues with the same sticker. Was there a line? What number were you? We complain today about tribalism and divisiveness, but voting is an act that we share across generations, borders, and beliefs. We invest it with our experiences and our hopes and our fears. It is a moment of commitment. When we cast our ballot, we're doing so in the hopes of making a change, but we also understand how utterly singular we are. Will it make a difference? At least we've been counted.
Molly McGregor. To me, it's noteworthy that E.B. White, who's one of the greatest of prose stylists, chooses to define democracy in large part as a feeling. It's the feeling of privacy in the voting booths, the feeling of communion in the libraries, the feeling of vitality everywhere. Any American who's visited a country that's a dictatorship, one man, one party rule, immediately feels the absence, the negative of what we take for granted. And to defend and revitalize our democracy, it helps, I think, to realize that it's not just a set of rules or ideas, that it's a way of living, that it involves our whole selves. Here's one more footnote to E.B. White's definition, this one from our program's Doctor of Library and Information Sciences, Christine Jenkins.
When I was in elementary school, after I learned to read on my own, I would visit the Linden Hills branch of the Minneapolis Public Library with my mother. When we walked together through the library door, my mother went upstairs and I went downstairs to the children's room. And for the next hour or so, I was on my own. Horse stories, The Black Stallion, Misty of Chincoteague, dog stories about collies or Irish setters or Alaskan sled dogs, and books about children my age. I remember The Saturdays by Elizabeth Enright, a book set in the early 1940s in New York City. There were four Melody children who lived in a shabby Manhattan brownstone. They created a club, the Independent Saturday Afternoon Adventure Club. They would pool their weekly allowances and take turns, on Saturdays of course, using that money to do something that they wanted to do on their own, something that cost more than they could afford by themselves. Randy, who loved to draw and paint, went to an art gallery to see paintings by French Impressionists, a benefit for war relief. Rush, fiercely devoted to classical music, took himself to an opera matinee. 14-year-old Mona, the oldest, had always worn her long hair in braids, but on her Saturday, she visited a beauty salon for the first time and spent the afternoon having her hair cut, set, dried, styled, and going from braids to billowing waves. Her family responded to her new look with shock and alarm at first, but eventually followed by acceptance. Oliver, the youngest, used his first Saturday to go to the circus in Madison Square Garden. Like me, these were good kids who relished an opportunity to have an independent adventure, and this was what I was doing as well, spending an hour on my own, dipping into library materials, any of the several thousand books on the shelves of the children's room. Other kids were there too, of course, also on their own, with the books that they, like me, chose to read for themselves. I was on my own. In coming to the library, I was joining a democratic community of readers. The younger ones were in the room with me, the older ones on the floor above, engaged in the same activity of choosing what they wanted to read for themselves. You will not be surprised to know I grew up to be a librarian. In my work, first as a school librarian and then as a library school faculty member teaching courses on youth services librarianship, I learned about the history of public libraries and library service to young people. The earliest libraries in this country were attached to churches and universities. Their use was limited to members of religious or academic communities. As literacy became more important, the well-to-do established subscription libraries along the lines of private clubs. Workers and their employees saw the value of literacy and joined together to create apprentice or mechanics libraries that were funded by regular membership dues or fees. But of course, access to all of these libraries were limited to those who could afford them. From the 19th century beginnings, though, public libraries were slowly beginning to appear. The underlying premise of these free public libraries was free access, though they weren't as open as those of today. After all, books were commonly kept in those days on the shelves behind the circulation desk and then were requested by author, title, or call number. Early restrictions also commonly included age requirements. You had to be age 14 and above, 12 and above, or some possessing the fine motor dexterity to fit one's first and last name on a single line of the application. Then in 1899, steel magnate Andrew Carnegie initiated a new program of library construction. Carnegie was no self-sacrificing hero, but rather a canny businessman who knew the value of a literate workforce and had the millions to invest in his vision. Carnegie Corporation would pay for the construction of the physical library, but a community's application to the Carnegie Corporation included commitment to provide the building site and ongoing public funding. As a public library, the community made a commitment to provide free access to all community members. Few towns that requested a grant and agreed to his terms were refused. By the time the last grant was made in 1919, there were 3,500 libraries in the U.S., nearly half of them built with construction grants paid by Carnegie. The public library was for adults and indirectly for children, but age limits again were common. Enter Anne Carroll Moore, woman with vision. In 1896, she graduated from Pratt Institute and was accepted an offer to organize a children's room at that institution. Up to this point, children were usually considered a nuisance in library settings and often were excluded from libraries until they were 14 or 12. As part of her research into the proposed children's room, Moore visited kindergartens, toured various ethnic neighborhoods, even questioned children who she encountered on the street. She set out to create a welcoming space for children. Child-sized furniture, open stacks, story times, puppet shows, summer programming, quality juvenile literature, and perhaps most importantly, librarians committed to working with children. New York City was a city of immigrants, of course, and Moore initiated a policy of inclusion, celebrating the ethnic diversity of her patrons through story times, poetry readings, and books that celebrated the various backgrounds of recent immigrants to the city. When children became card-holding members of the New York Public Library, and many, many did, the children were required to sign a ledger promising to treat books respectfully and to return them. Quote, "When I write my name in this book, I promise to take good care of the books I use in the library and at home and to obey the rules of the library." For tens of thousands of New York children, this was their first act of civic engagement as an individual. Happily, the library kept those ledgers. Decades later, those children, now adults, would visit the library to see their own signature, their own first act of civic engagement. I think of the chant from the demonstration at Wisconsin State Capitol Building in Madison. Thousands of people chanting, "Show me what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. The public library. This is what democracy looks like."
Thanks to Christine Jenkins, Jack Nachbar, Fred Friedman, Matthew Miltich, and Molly McGregor for joining us today. My name is Michael Goldberg, wishing you a safe and fun 4th of July. Have a proud and hopeful one, too. Remember E.B. White's definition of democracy. He says, it's the mustard on the hot dog, the cream in the coffee. Let's celebrate with James Brown to Stay Human.